Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Melina, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Medical Update on Pancreatic Cancer. And I know that many of you have waited for us to do this program for a while, so we're really delighted to have so many of you on the call today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 924 participants. It is probably the largest teleconference that we've offered on pancreatic cancer in terms of the numbers of you that have chosen to be with us for the next hour. So there's 924 of you on this call today. And you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and states. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, India, Korea, the Philippines, Turkey, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and you are truly a group of information seekers. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, we have sent you information about our speakers and also the topics they'll be covering, and we also have sent you an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs that we should be offering. So we very much depend upon your feedback to keep these programs the most relevant to meet your needs. So please do tell us the topics you'd like us to offer. Indeed, this topic's one that you have asked us to offer, and here it is. And so, again, do you fill out those evaluation forms. Also, in the materials we sent you is all the information about all the collaborating organizations, their websites and 800 numbers as additional resources for you in addition to Cancer Care. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Genentech Bio-Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Ephraim Casper. He's Head Division of Network Medicine Services, Attending Physician, Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's actually spoken on many occasions on these programs, and he's going to cover an overview of pancreatic cancer, current standard of care, and communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Casper?
Carolyn, thank you, and welcome to everyone. I thought I'd actually begin with a couple of introductory comments, and the first is that I'm honored that so many people have subscribed to today's conference. I want to really acknowledge the patients. Pancreas cancer, as you all well know, is a difficult disease, and I am daily struck by the courage and determination of our patients with pancreatic cancer. And I think that it's courageous really even to call in and hear what we have to say. I've also learned that the patients with pancreas cancer are extremely resilient. And so I admire you, and I hope that today will be helpful for you. You give us inspiration. I'd also say that I imagine that there are a number of caregivers on the line, and you are an awesome group of people who also add incredibly to the success that we have with treating the patients with pancreatic cancer. Carolyn mentioned the word collaboration, the collaboration that goes into planning a conference like this and supporting a teleconference like this. I think collaboration is a key word in pancreatic cancer. It is really a disease that requires combined modality collaboration among the medical specialists, but is successful when there is collaboration between the patient and their families or caregivers and the medical care team, and we'll get to that a little bit at the end of my comments. Pancreas cancer, as I said, is a challenging disease for many reasons. It's a difficult disease to diagnose. There are no good screening tests. The onset is insidious. People don't have specific symptoms. And even with today's outstanding and innovative imaging modalities, it's not always easily identified by x-rays or scans. it's a difficult disease to treat, and we've gotten much better at it, but it is a disease that is associated with some organ dysfunction in some patients and with other comorbidities. It occurs in patients who have other medical problems. It's a disease with a median age of about 70, so there are many patients who are elderly and frail who present with this disease, and those patients present special challenges. What has inhibited us in the past, I think, and I think we're overcoming this, is that there's been tremendous pessimism about the treatment and investigation of pancreas cancer. We've overcome that with some of our innovative therapies, with some of our newer surgical procedures, and with an appreciation that there are things that the medical profession can offer patients. I think that it's the patients who keep us going on this, and again, I thank you for that. Pancreas cancer is expected to occur in some 43,000 Americans this year. So it is a very common cancer, and one in which we need to do a lot more work. The risk factors for pancreas cancer are cigarette smoking. There's family history that's important. But truthfully, this is a disease which can strike anyone, and the greatest risk factor is actually getting older. So we are all at risk for it, and it's a disease that we really need to work on identifying early and not so easy to do. I'd like to talk a little bit about the anatomy and physiology of the pancreas so that we have an understanding about what we're talking about. The pancreas is an organ which has two distinct functions. The pancreas is located deep in the abdomen between the stomach and the backbone. It is only about 6 inches in length, and it's surrounded by not only organs like the liver and the stomach, but it has a rich vascular blood vessel supply. It has a supply of lymph nodes and lymph channels, the garbage cans, the garbage collectors of the body, and a rich nerve supply. So it's an area that is hard to get at surgically, but it's an area that's very, very important. So the two major functions of the pancreas are digestive and endocrine. The pancreas produces juices that help us digest our food, and within the pancreas there are ducts, tubes, that take those juices into the intestinal tract. It is the pancreatic duct that is the source of most pancreas cancers, what is called exocrine pancreatic cancer or the typical adenocarcinoma of the pancreas. And it's really for that disease that we're going to focus our comments today. The other function of the pancreas is to produce hormones like insulin, like glucagon, other things that are very, very important for the body. Those are produced by cells in the pancreas called islet cells, and those two cells can become malignant, and they can be benign as well as malignant tumors that arise in the islet cells. Those are called endocrine or neuroendocrine tumors. Interesting developments in therapy are going on there as well, but that's not the focus of discussion today. So how do patients walk in the front door and tell us that they had pancreas cancer? And many of you have been through this experience. And sometimes patients don't know that they have it, but the most common presentation is abdominal pain. And because abdominal pain occurs so commonly, pancreas cancer is not high on the list of diagnoses when patients first come to see the doctor. So we look for other supporting signs or symptoms. Many patients present with weight loss. It's not unusual for patients to come in jaundiced. Back pain is not uncommon. Sometimes patients come in with more severe abdominal or gastrointestinal symptoms like vomiting. They often complain of gas. And I'm sure for you there may be the frustration of, or may have been the frustration of, trying to explain to your doctor what it was that you were really feeling. And the word that patients use the most is gas, in my experience, and that means a lot of different things to different people. And we'll get into being clear with your doctor and healthcare team about what you're actually experiencing. So when patients present with those symptoms, sooner or later they end up getting either a CT scan, sometimes an MRI, sometimes a sonogram, and a pancreatic mass is identified, or a mass near the pancreas, or not infrequently, signs that a tumor has spread and a suggestion that has actually the spread has been from the pancreas. So the first time an oncologist or surgeon sees the patient often is when they've already had an X-ray study. So the job of the treatment care team at that point is really to stage the patient. And while there are staging systems that are very specific based on measurement of tumor and involvement of lymph nodes or spread of disease, really the question that is in the doctor's mind is this a patient who ought to have an operation? Is this something that should come out? Or is this something that I can't take out or cannot come out and this patient needs other therapy? That's really the decision. And we sort of used to think of pancreas cancer in terms of resectable and unresectable. Increasingly, we are recognizing that there are patients who have what is called today borderline resectable. These are patients who have disease which is localized, but it's not going to be easy for the surgeon to take out. And there are patients who have disease that's located only in the pancreatic bed, no evidence of spread, but there's reason to think that the surgeon's just never going to be able to take it out. So there is this spectrum. But really the first thing we think about is this a patient who ought to be seeing a surgeon because this is potentially resectable? If a patient does have a tumor which is localized and which can come out surgically, then they see a surgeon and that surgery it should be done by somebody who's skilled at doing the surgery. And when the tumor is out and when the cancer has been removed, we still know that those patients are at risk for having relapse of their tumor. So those patients today are often offered chemotherapy after their operation and some both chemotherapy and radiation. With those therapies, we know that we can prevent that tumor from coming back in a proportion of patients. Knowing that, the idea arose, well, if those therapies are useful in preventing a tumor that has been removed from coming back, maybe we could apply those therapies to patients who have a tumor that can't come out and use that before an operation and make it so that that tumor can come out. So one of the strategies we are using now is something called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, chemotherapy given before an operation in an attempt to take a tumor which can't quite come out now and get it to a point where it can come out. That is an approach which is being used increasingly, and it points out how important it is to have that collaboration among surgeons, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, as well as primary care doctors. Obviously, there are patients and a substantial proportion of patients in whom who walk in the front door with tumor that has already spread. And when pancreas cancer spreads, it generally, not exclusively, but generally spreads within the abdomen, either to the abdominal cavity itself or to organs in the abdomen, specifically the liver. In a situation of a disease that has spread, we generally will apply chemotherapy for a patient who's fit and able to tolerate it. Chemotherapy for many years was limited to one or two drugs. For 20 years, we used a drug called fluorouracil. Starting in the 1990s, we began using a drug called gemcitabine, known commercially as Gemzar. And today, we have evidence that for selected patients, combining drugs, using two or three drugs, can often result in a better outcome. That decision needs to be made by the medical oncologist as well as the patient, because when you give more drugs, you get more side effects. And I think that's maybe an appropriate time to go to the issue of speaking with your physician. Everybody is pressed for time, and I don't take that as an excuse. I take that as a challenge. Our time is limited. We give you small blocks of time, 15, 20, 30 minutes when you come in for visits. You have a lot of things to do. We don't want to waste time. We want to make the best use of our time. And that comes from honesty, both from the patient and from the doctor. And it's often hard to be honest because patients sometimes don't want to share how they're feeling. They're afraid what the doctor is going to tell. The doctor sometimes doesn't quite know what the patient wants to know. So developing a dialogue with your healthcare team is extremely important. I think that one of the wonderful things that's happened, but it is a double-edged sword, is the availability of information on the Internet. And the Internet has a lot of information, and it has a lot of non-information or disinformation. It's not always accurate. As you know, it's not edited. It's a good place to start. There are some very reliable websites, and we can talk about them later. But it's a good place to start thinking about what are your questions. I think it's very important and very helpful when patients come in with a list of their questions, and when they come in with that list, they ought to be writing down the answers. I often have patients read off their whole list of questions and then try to put them in some sort of order, but I ask that they write those answers down because it's very, very useful for them to go back and look at those answers and understand it so they don't have to ask the same question time and time again. It's very useful for patients to keep a journal. They can write down their symptoms, they can write down their concerns, they can write down their feelings and share that with the healthcare team. I mentioned the caregivers before. Bringing an extra set of ears is extremely helpful at a consultation or at a visit. Always having somebody else who can hear for you and help you ask questions. I would caution patients and caregivers that one has to be careful what they ask, because if we're going to establish a dialogue where there's honesty, then I will answer your questions. And sometimes a caregiver has a burning question that the patient doesn't want to know the answer to. And sometimes the patient is afraid that their caregivers or their family are going to hear an answer to something, and they really want their family to understand. So there needs to be discussion about whether or not everybody in the room wants to hear the answer to the question, or whether the question should be even be asked of everybody in the room. The final point I'd make about talking to your doctor is that the time to talk to a doctor is not only the visit that you have once every few weeks or once a month. You should call. You should be in touch with the healthcare team, and you should make it known if your questions are not being answered. We owe that to you. I think most doctors really want to answer your questions. And if the questions are appropriate and are not duplicative, I think that the overwhelming majority of physicians will treat those questions with respect. So to sort of sum it up, I hope I've given you a sense for how we think about pancreas cancer, about the options for different stages of diseases, and I would conclude by saying that one of the wonderful things about patients who we treat is that they really want to move the field ahead, and we only can move the field ahead through the involvement of patients in clinical trials, and I know that Dr. Verachary is going to be addressing that. So thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Casper, for just an outstanding presentation and really for your great expertise, but also your great compassion and just so informative. So thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Gauri Varatachari. And Dr. Varachary is Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of GI Medical Oncology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Varachary is going to address the important role of clinical trials, pain and symptom management, and quality of life concerns. And Dr. Varachary has also been a frequent presenter on our programs, and I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Varachary.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hello, everyone. I echo Dr. Casper's introductory remarks. Thanks, patients, caregivers, supporters, and friends for joining us today. Let me start with giving you an overview of what clinical trials involve and some of the terminology we use. So the first question is, why is it important to participate in a clinical trial? We have not made significant strides in pancreatic cancer today like we have in other cancers. Physicians and patients are constantly exploring new ways to treat pancreatic cancer, and we believe that through innovative research and clinical trials and understanding the biology of pancreatic cancer and which drugs work and don't work, we will be able to make large strides for this challenging disease. So there are a few important questions that come up, and it's important that you ask your doctor when evaluating or presented a clinical trial. So what I would like to do is to first go through the three phases of clinical trial, what exactly does that involve, and then come up with a few questions that may be helpful to ask your doctor. So we typically talk about three phases of clinical trial. There is a phase four as well, but it's not too relevant for our discussion today. So the first is a phase one trial. So what is a phase one clinical trial? And it is important to know what it involves because several pancreatic cancer patients will be offered a phase one trial. Now, these are the earliest trials in the life of a new drug or treatment. They are usually small trials and recruit 15 to 30 patients. The trial may be open to people with any type of cancer, not just pancreatic cancer patients. And typically, this trial is done to build on what we have learned from the laboratory, the cell studies, the animal studies. Now, patients entering phase one trials often have advanced cancer and have usually undergone treatment available to them. So in pancreatic cancer patients, it is not uncommon to have patients who have taken some chemotherapy, some gemcitabine-based chemotherapy, single agent or with other drugs. The aim of the phase one trial is to look for a safe dose range for a new drug and side effects. And patients may not benefit from the treatment because no data about benefit is available as yet. Phase one trials are important because they are the first steps in finding new treatments for the future. So any drug that is commercially available today and that is used in patients with pancreatic cancer has gone through a phase one trial. Patients are usually recruited quite slowly on a phase one trial, and it can take a long time to complete. The dose is gradually increased, and often there are lots of blood tests that need to be done. An occasional phase one trial may also have some biopsies involved. And the idea here is to find out how exactly the drug is affecting the body and how the body gets rid of the drug. So that's your phase one. The next is the phase two trials. A phase two trial is done to find out if the new treatment for pancreatic cancer works well enough to test it further in phase three trials and learn more about side effects and how to manage them and the best dose to use in pancreatic cancer patients. A typical phase two trial is much larger than a phase one. It can have up to 100 patients or more. The results of a phase two trial show that this new treatment may be or better or as good as the existing treatment. And based on the signal you get from the phase two trial, it then moves to the phase three. Some of the phase two trials are randomized, which means that the researchers will have a group of patients taking the experimental drug and a group of patients taking the current standard treatment. And this is done randomly after the patient signs up for the trial. After phase two, we talk about phase three trials. These trials compare new treatments with the best currently available treatment, the so-called standard treatment. Phase three trials are usually much larger than phase two trials, and it needs many patients in the trial to show the difference. It usually involves many hospitals and often even across continents. Phase three trials are almost always randomized. A group gets the new treatment and the other group gets the standard treatment, and again done randomly after the patient signs up for the trial. So bottom line, there are many trials, phase one, early phase two, phase three, and more than 100, 150 in the United States that are enrolling patients with pancreatic cancer to study novel therapies. The trials could involve novel targeted agents. There are novel drugs, nanospheres, gene therapy, and it's really difficult sometimes to navigate the internet, like Dr. Casper said, to figure out what is best for you. There are some websites, and you know, I I don't want to go through the whole list, but just to mention a couple, www.cancer.gov, www.clinicaltrials.gov, and others. But most importantly, you should talk to your doctor about your options. And if there is a specific novel drug or combination or trial that has come up, sometimes, you know, there is media hype and you see a lot more in the newspaper before you even see anything in the publication. And if you bring it up to your doctor, the open communication, like Dr. Casper mentioned, is extremely important so that the doctor can guide you to a trial that is fit for you. So what are some of the other questions you can ask your doctor? What phase trial is being offered to me? When you are actively evaluating a trial, there are some additional questions that come up. Are the side effects of this trial different from the current non-trial option if I'm being offered one, or the drugs that I've tried in the past? Once I sign up for the trial, can I stop any time? Will it be inpatient or outpatient? Most often for pancreatic cancer, the treatment is outpatient. How often are the blood tests done? Do I need a line put in or a porta cath put in? Will my insurance pay for the expenses involved? Some of this is already covered when the research nurse or the research team is talking to you, but just to make sure that all the questions have been answered. Which doctors will be in charge of my care once I'm on the trial? Sometimes it's a switch in the team based on the research trial that is being offered. Are there any special instructions for my family members? So bottom line, you should feel comfortable signing up for a clinical trial and feel that you are part of the research team and that this is the best option for you going into the study. I'm going to switch gear and talk about managing side effects and pain. And let me start with saying that patients with pancreatic cancer do have pain, but the most important thing to remember is that in most patients, pain can be managed very, very effectively. The severity and the prevalence of pain does depend on the position of the tumor, the stage of the cancer, and the location of metastases. As we are all aware, pain affects each person differently, depending on several factors, their age, their perception, their pain threshold, their past experiences with pain. We also know that depression, poor sleep, fatigue, and anxiety can affect the pain threshold. So the goal of pain management is twofold. One, to make the patient pain-free, and also to make the patient as functional as possible. And the treatment approaches are usually classified as either pharmacological, which is involving drugs, and non-pharmacological. So what are our pharmacological pain control options? These, of course, usually involve using painkillers called analgesics in conjunction with other medications, and often patients also need opioids, which are much stronger narcotic pain medications. The other medications that are used with these are used to help alleviate or prevent common side effects associated with pain medications, like laxatives for constipation, or to enhance the effectiveness of pain medication like antidepressants. There are patients who need narcotics, and we use that often for pain treatment. It is important, again, to talk to your doctor regularly about your pain medication needs and any side effects caused by pain medication. Doctors do have to educate the patients regarding some of these side effects and prescribe additional drugs to make sure that we manage the side effects effectively. Some patients with pancreatic cancer may be candidates for a procedure called as a celiac plexus block, and this is an invasive procedure rather than using drugs. And it's typically beneficial for patients where you have tumor infiltration of the nerves around the pancreas, the celiac axis. And using the imaging studies, the CAT scan, and the patient's pain pattern and their use of narcotics, the doctor can then decide whether the celiac plexus block, doing a nerve block, is a good idea for that patient. Either alcohol or phenol is administered through a needle anterior of the first vertebra. So it's done by a pain team. Typically, these are anesthesiologists, and it's an invasive procedure done in a controlled setting, but it's still outpatient. And it may reduce the need for opioids in some of our patients for several months. There are other non-pharmacological approaches that could be used, again, based on the presentation. Radiation in selected patients, especially if the pain is coming from the primary tumor or bone metastases, and rarely in very selected patients there are neurosurgical techniques like an epidural pump that may be helpful, but again, that's a selective procedure and not often used in our situation. At times, behavioral techniques also using deep breathing exercises or meditation can be helpful. There are other symptoms that I would like to talk about very briefly. One is jaundice. And jaundice develops when there is blockage of the bile ducts. It can cause loss of appetite, weight loss, nausea, and itching. And while jaundice can be relieved by using a surgical bypass of the bile ducts, it's not usually recommended for patients with advanced pancreatic cancer because of the long recovery period associated with the surgery. And the treatment of choice in this situation is insertion of a tube called a stent. This is done by a gastroenterologist, and the plastic or metal stents are available. And it can be done quite effectively to alleviate this symptom. In a small number of patients, with advanced pancreatic cancer, there can be a growth of tumor around the duodenum that can block the bowels and can cause difficulty in eating and cause persistent vomiting. In some patients, a stent or a tube to release gastric juices may be beneficial. Many patients, I'm doing a wrap-up by talking about quality of life. Many patients have concerns about quality of life, and it's really important that patients discuss these issues with the healthcare team. And I see quality of life as patients' self-perceived health status. It is really crucial that the doctor and the patient evaluate this on a regular, ongoing basis. There's a lot that can be done for depression, pain, fatigue, weight loss, and chemotherapy-related side effects. And it is important that patients, their family, and the cancer team continue to have an open communication to maximize the quality of life for a patient and to make the best decisions for them. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Acharya, for just really a comprehensive encyclopedic review of a lot of the issues and management of side effects that you've presented. Just very helpful to everybody, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Maria Petzl, and we actually do represent here the multidisciplinary team. So Maria Petzl is a dietitian. She's senior clinical dietitian, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Maria is going to address managing weight loss and eating hints. I now turn the program over to Maria.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thanks to all of those of you who are participating in this call today. We really appreciate you taking the time out of the day and hope that we're able to provide you some additional information. My focus today is really to discuss two main points, controlling weight loss and to provide some just general eating hints. Our nutrition goals are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition, to maintain dose and schedule of cancer treatments, to manage symptoms, to maintain or improve weight and strength, and to maximize quality of life. Now, with regards to weight loss, there can be many causes of weight loss. These can include inadequate intake because of side effects of treatment, such as poor appetite, taste changes, early satiety, which is feeling full early, nausea or vomiting, etc. Also, weight loss can be a result of hypermetabolism or something called cancer cachexia, which is the cancer causing the body to need more calories and burn more calories. And also malabsorption. Malabsorption can be a result of diarrhea that's caused as a treatment side effect, a side effect of surgery, or simply pancreatic enzyme insufficiency. So the pancreas is not producing enough digestive enzymes to digest all the food that we're eating. So symptoms of pancreatic insufficiency or digestive insufficiency include feelings of indigestion, cramping after meals, large amounts of gas, foul-smelling gas or stools, floating stools or greasy or fatty stools, frequent stools, loose stools or diarrhea, and unexplained weight loss. Now, these symptoms could be any one or two or all of these symptoms that patients may experience. It's important that we keep in mind that many pain medications can cause constipation, and the constipating effects of pain medication can mask the symptoms of frequent or loose bowel movements that digestive insufficiency can cause. So if patients have symptoms of indigestion, cramping, bloating, excessive gas, or uncontrolled weight loss, but they have normal bowel movements, they may have pancreatic exocrine insufficiency or digestive insufficiency, but they're just not having the loose bowel movements that we characteristically think go along with the digestive insufficiency, because the pain medication is masking that. So it's really important to discuss with your medical team if you have some of these symptoms, perhaps supplementing with pancreatic enzymes and treating constipation with laxatives or stool softeners will help with managing symptoms. Now, the pancreatic enzymes that we use are actually prescription pancreatic enzymes, so it is important that you talk with your medical team. And also, it's important to know that everybody is different. Each patient needs different amounts of enzymes. The amount varies depending on the disease, on the treatment, and the amount of fat in the diet. And not all enzymes are created equal, so it's important once you find the brand and the dose that works for you that you stick with that. Moving along to some general nutrition tips, these tips can help manage many of the side effects that patients may feel, which can include poor appetite, nausea, early satiety. So I commonly recommend that patients eat small, frequent meals. Instead of three large meals a day, eat six or eight small meals a day. Plan your meals or your snacks the day before. This can help eliminate some of those family fights or disagreements or concerns where a patient doesn't feel like eating and the family is trying to feed the patient and trying to get them to find something that works well for them. If you plan your meals and snacks the day before, then you start to eat using a schedule rather than trying to depend on the body to tell you that it's hungry and depend on the body to tell you what it wants to eat. So planning those meals and snacks the day before can help eliminate some of those stresses. It's also important to monitor your use of fats. Some people will have concerns, will have issues with digesting fats. So if this is an issue for you, then limit your portions of fat-containing foods. Also, high-fat foods can cause more feelings of fullness and can contribute to nausea and vomiting. It's important to choose nutrient-dense foods. So these are foods that are going to have a lot of vitamins, minerals, protein, calories. So it's good to choose good whole foods, like having a sandwich, so having bread and meat and vegetables on your sandwich versus having a candy bar, which has not as much nutrition. It has the calories, but it doesn't have all the other good vitamins and minerals that go along with it. And also being active. Activity can play a role in helping enhance appetite. It can help you your mood. It can help with digestion. So being active, even if it's just 5 minutes at a time, any kind of activity can be helpful. A common side effect that I want to spend just another extra minute on is diarrhea. So diarrhea can be a result of treatment. It can be a result of surgery. It could be a result of other medications. Regardless of the cause of diarrhea, when somebody is having loose, frequent bowel movements, there are some things you can do to help reduce the frequency of the bowel movements and help support the body. So the first is to limit lactose-containing foods or use the enzyme that helps break down lactose, and that's called lactase. And a common brand name for that is lactaid pills. So you can take the lactaid pills with any meal or snack containing dairy, and that way you're not cutting that good calorie and protein source out of your diet, but rather you're treating the symptom and reducing the lactose. When somebody is having diarrhea, it's important to reduce insoluble fiber from the diet. So insoluble fiber is what we think of as roughage. So these are what we get from our whole grains, our brown rice, our whole wheat pasta, raw fruits and vegetables with thick peels. We want to reduce these in times of diarrhea because it could actually make it worse. We want to limit or avoid foods that are sugar, that are sweetened with sugar alcohols, or also foods that are high in sugar in general. Things you can do to help are to increase sources of soluble fiber. So soluble fiber acts as a gel. It traps the extra water. We get soluble fiber from the inside of the apple, so apple without the peel or applesauce. Soluble fiber from bananas, the greener the better. From oat products, so whole oats, so oatmeal or something like Cheerios. And from the citrus fruits without a lot of the membrane. We want to use high potassium and high sodium foods to replace those electrolyte losses. And sometimes it's appropriate to use electrolyte-containing drinks, such as the children's electrolyte fluids or oral rehydration solutions or diluted sports drinks. This can help replace the potassium and the sodium and get plenty of fluids to prevent dehydration. So just some tips on what patients should eat. It is important to have a little extra focus on protein foods. So protein foods are going to be good things like lean cuts of meat, skinless chicken, skinless turkey, also beans, peas, or lentils if you're not having a lot of gas and you can tolerate these foods. Beans or lentils, these are great sources of protein. Using dairy products, oftentimes fat-free or low-fat are going to be better tolerated. Using milk alternatives like soy milk or rice milk. Meat alternatives like veggie burgers or tofu. Also protein powders. These can be used in smoothies. These can be mixed in with soups. And also nuts and seeds as tolerated. I mentioned smoothies and using protein powder. That's one type of small, quick meal that a person could use. Also using commercially available liquid supplements like Boost, Ensure, Glucerna, or Boost Glucose Control. There's some newer products that are available on the market, such as a product called Mix One and Orgain. And these are more towards your health food store type items. So they have the Orgain is actually completely organic, pre-made liquid nutritional drink. So any of these might be helpful and could count as small meals or small snacks. They're things that you can take on the go with you when you're going to doctor's appointments and you get caught in the waiting room longer than you expect. And finally, I just want to give a couple of nutrition resources. There is a comprehensive nutrition booklet about diet and nutrition that's available through the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, and that's free. You can find them on the web, or you can call their 1-800 number. And then also, finding a registered dietitian can be very helpful to help individually give you a customized nutrition plan. Ask for a consult with the dietitian at your local cancer center. If there's not a dietitian available, contact Cancer Care or contact the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, and they can help give you guidance on how to find a dietitian who specializes in oncology. Again, I want to thank all of you for taking part in this conference call, and I'll turn it back over to Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much. It was an excellent presentation, just very informative, Maria, and you gave lots of very specific tips to people. This is such an important area and often very challenging, so Maria really did an excellent job. Thank you. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra, and Liz is an oncology social worker. She's our pancreatic cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Liz is going to review with you the free support services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as the importance of a support network. I'm going to turn the program now over to my colleague, Liz.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with pancreatic cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support service to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance for transportation and also some chemo copay assistance for pancreatic cancer are all provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and how his or her family and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a pancreatic cancer telephone support group as well as an online group for pancreatic caregivers. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care's services, please call us at 1-800-813-4673 or at our website at www.cancercare.org. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you so much, Liz, and thank you really for your great work in this area and really for explaining to everybody the services that they can access from Cancer Care. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Melina explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I'm also going to ask Melina to bring all of our speakers on board so that we can all be here to address your questions. And Melina, if you would explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. And I just want to say, because there are so many people on the call today, if we do not get to your question, please call Cancer Care after the call, 1-800-813-HOPE. Call us, and our staff will be here to help you. So please do that if you don't get to ask your question. Melina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Mary Ellen M.
Hi. When you have indigestion all the time, what is the best thing to do for that?
That's an excellent question. Thank you, Mary Ellen. And I'm going to ask Dr. Varachari to address that question about indigestion.
I did not hear the whole question.
The question was really just in terms of dealing with indigestion and some tips and help for having indigestion all the time. And if you could just answer that question in a general way in terms of things that are often helpful and also in terms of course, bringing that back to one's healthcare team.
Right. Maria had discussed earlier, it's important to understand what's the root cause of the indigestion, whether it is related to pancreatic insufficiency. So the doctor needs to ask the patient whether with the indigestion there's a lot of gas symptoms, is there any diarrhea? And treatment for that would be pancreatic enzymes. Sometimes the indigestion may be related to certain medications the patient is taking. And one would also like to ask the patient whether they are on an acid blocker. And we also look into that, especially patients who have undergone a surgery and have continued indigestion. They tend to take medications like omeprazole or Nexium for a very, very long time along with their pancreatic enzymes. Beside that, it would also be important to understand if there's any mechanical issues that are responsible for the indigestion symptoms. So it's a pretty open symptom that may have other underlying issues that need to be looked into, but the most common would be either acid-related or pancreatic insufficiency-related symptom, which can be treated.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Marjorie P.
Hi. I'm kind of looking at pancreatic cancer at the mountain that I consider to be pancreatic cancer from a different angle, and that is that my mother died of it. And I wanted to add a few things that were already said and also to ask one question. Number one, the Internet is a huge benefit. It can be scary with the information on it, but I would recommend anybody go to the John Hopkins Pancreatic Cancer message board.
And Marjorie, did you want to ask the question?
Yeah, well, where are they doing on finding a test for this, a screening test? It's, all this stuff is of benefit, but if you don't catch it early enough, how is, you know, what's the point?
Well, Marjorie, thank you very much for your question, and we also offer our condolences on your mother's death, and I'm going to ask Dr. Casper if he would address the issue around the issue of screening, which is an excellent, really an excellent point.
Sure. Thank you very much for the question. It's a difficult and frustrating problem for us. I think that one of the things that we try to do is to identify high-risk patients, and sometimes that's, if you can identify a group of high-risk patients, that's a better group of people to start exploring screening tests in. You're just more likely to find something. Pancreas cancer is not a uniform disease. We have, it doesn't always produce something that we can measure in blood, so that's difficult. It's not easy to image, and imaging carries with it risks as well. So we share those frustrations. There are studies going on trying to look at proteins, looking at other markers that might be present in the bloodstream, but it is unsolved and is an area of intense research.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Dave E.
Oh, great. Hey, thanks so much for providing this information. This is very helpful. I have a question. My mom needs to be on TPN, and she's currently inpatient, and it's been a challenge to find a place, a outpatient or somebody to come into the home or a clinic that would take her. Do you have any specific suggestions around, I guess there's some insurance or legal issues around administering TPN?
Excellent. That's an excellent question, David. I'm going to ask Dr. Casper if you could begin by addressing that.
Sure. I can only begin. I think the this is a responsibility of the team that has decided to provide TPN, and presumably the people who have thought that that is the right thing to do for your mother work with other people to try to get that kind of treatment at home. In our institution, we would be working with our social workers and our nutritionists to figure out, one, is this the best thing to do, and how can we do it?
Excellent. So I'll bring in the other team members. Thank you. I thought that I was wondering, this is really, David, your question is wonderful because it does involve our entire team of speakers here. I'm going to ask both Liz and Linda to comment on this as well. Liz, did you want to comment just in terms of just resources and how we help people with these decisions?
Well, I think the best way to do it is to make a connection with either a social worker at the hospital or by calling cancer care and speaking to somebody here. I do usually get all the pancreatic cancer calls that come in, so you would probably be speaking to me, and we would just go through everything, help you to formulate where you wanted to go next and finding resources in your area that you would be able to utilize.
Excellent. Thank you, Liz. And Maria, did you want to add anything?
Case management, so is sometimes a different department. It's maybe a nurse and rather than a social worker, and the case manager within an inpatient facility can help with the transition to an outpatient, to home care for TPN or to an outpatient facility. So checking with a case manager may also be helpful.
Excellent. And Dr. Varachari, did you want to add anything?
I echo what others have said. It is something the team that has planned on the TPN they need to tie all the loose ends before the patient is discharged. Often a patient comes in for 5 or 6 days to start the TPN, based on the reasons why the patient needs to be on TPN, and then they go home. And when that transition is made, the doctors, the case managers, the home care nursing TPN team, all is involved because it's quite an involved process, even at home, with blood tests that need to be done weekly. So all that needs to be in place when this decision is made.
So this is really, and David, I think I really want to thank you for your question, because you're pulling in the whole team. And also you're bringing up the point, you're the caregiver here, and you are, your mom is fortunate that you're her son, because actually you are looking into all these details, and indeed the safety in terms of before your mom goes home, before any decisions are made, everything is in place. So I hope that you have some resources now to call upon to really think this through, and so that everything is in place before your mom goes home. I think that's really the most important thing here. I want to thank our speakers. They've really been outstanding. This has been a remarkable call. I have to say this has been kind of a record call, amazing, all of you. I want to thank all of you who have asked such really extraordinary questions and contributed so much to the call. And I want to thank all of you who have been listening as well. And we do recognize that, of course, this is a one-hour program and that you all have so many needs beyond the scope of this 1 hour. So we hope that you are now leaving this call with information, loaded with lots of information, and also with resources and places to call. And I think, as Liz has said, we don't want you to feel that you're alone. If you have a question or concern, please do contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And you also have all the resources in your materials to contact, and hopefully that you will be able to kind of then use those resources to help you as you cope with living with pancreatic cancer. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.